flashes, huh? What's your favorite scary movie?
not that one.
And welcome back to Horror Queers. We're talking Purple Habit Scrubs. We're talking You Didn't Do Anything, But You Probably Will. And we're talking Conversion Therapy. And I'm Joe.
And I'm Trace. And we're talking The Lord Didn't Answer Me, But Your Father Did.
Bum, bum, ooh, bum. La, la.
Everyone, we are discussing Kieran Foy's Eli, a 2019 Netflix release.
Hmm. Yeah, it's our most contemporary film of the month, and I feel like this is probably going to be the one that fewer folks have seen.
Okay, so this was a first-time watch for me, Joe, but I know you've seen this before, and you have been wanting to cover this for a while, and I'm curious, why?
I mean, this was a bit of a utility player where I thought it could make an interesting episode of a new title that most people hadn't seen. But I watched this a couple years ago with Terry as part of a Halloween fundraiser watch that we did. It was a watch party thing. And I was really pleasantly surprised at how, you know, enjoyable this film is. I don't think it's going to rock anybody's world, but I think it's a solid under the radar pick.
Ooh, and actually, before we go any further, everyone, if you were listening to this and you have not seen this film, it is definitely a film that I put in the category of it takes a turn, and that turn is in like the last 10 minutes. So if you don't want to be spoiled, stop listening now, go watch this on Netflix, because we are about to spoil the fuck out of this awesome ending.
yeah, the ending is definitely worth sticking around for, and it can be spoiled. I would recommend it, so yeah, people should go and check it out.
And clearly you remembered it. I would recommend it. I think I'm a little softer on the film than you are, because I do, it's one of those things where what happens after the twist to me is a much more interesting movie than what we've had in the prior hour and 10 minutes. And so I want that movie, and it's good. I think this is solid. So I would recommend this. I will remember this because of that ending.
And folks, if it sounds like we're doing our new Patreon shtick, it's because this film is also really giving off vibes of recent titles that we have covered, such as Immaculate and The First Omen and The Original Omen. So the fact that we programmed this also in the same month as Abigail coming out is sort of wild.
This comes out the week Abigail comes out. That was not planned on our part, everyone, but you've got potentially evil child locked in a house with some adults. Similar concept.
It's absolutely, it's fuck around and find out the child version.
100%. So yeah, why go see Abigail this weekend when you can hang out with Eli instead?
You know what? Double bill it, because Abigail needs your money as well.
Okay, well, why don't I just jump into this? Because I was expecting kind of a bare bones production for this, Joe, but this was a Netflix dump because it was supposed to go to theaters.
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah, I definitely thought that this was just, you know, some random movie that they said, sure, we'll pay $5 million for that, and then we'll just have more original content.
Yeah, so this movie was written by David Chicherillo, and his biggest claim to fame, he's one of two writers on the movie Cheap Thrills. Have you ever seen Cheap Thrills?
The title sounds super familiar, but every time I read it, I'm like, have I seen this? Do I know this?
It's like Pat Healy, Sarah Paxton, and like this guy makes him do a bunch of dares to get a bunch of money.
No, I have not seen that.
Good movie. Very fucked up. But anyway, so this guy, Chicherillo, writes the script, but then the script was later edited by Ian Goldberg and Richard Nang. Now, these guys, we've actually covered them before because they both wrote The Autopsy of Jane Doe, and they were one of three writers, the other being Akilah Cooper, on The Nun 2.
50% ain't bad.
I thought you'd say that. But yeah, this script wound up on the 2015 blacklist. And everyone, if you don't know what that is, I'm pretty sure we went into a really in-depth discussion of the blacklist when we talked about...
I can't recall. You've definitely gone through it and been like, here's what it is. So yeah. I don't know, folks, remind us.
I don't know, but go Google the blacklist. It's fine. but producer Trevor Macy, who is a regular collaborator of Mike Flanagan's, he's produced most of, if not all of Mike Flanagan's films. He read the script and he championed it and was like, no, we're going to make this. So By March of 2017, Kieran Foy was announced to be the film's director. Kieran Foy, by the way, this is his third feature film. He got his start. I've never seen this one, but it was 2012's Citadel, and he also directed Sinister 2. So,
okay. Jump scares.
Also, all of them dealing with children.
Oh, okay. Maybe it's one of those things, I know how to get a good performance out of a young actor because I've done it multiple times.
Well, I remember when Citadel came out, I mean, it was 12 years ago, which again, it's weird to think 2012 was 12 years ago, but what that one is about, it's a widower who must raise his baby alone after an attack by a gang leaves his wife dead and him suffering from agoraphobia. So I think the whole thing takes place in a building.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so this gentleman has a type.
Very much so. But it's interesting because, okay, so the script was brought to him at a really strange time because it was when his son was 2 weeks old. So, you know, he's got a newborn. He's not really reading scripts. In his words, I could barely see, never mind read.
So tired all the time.
But his agent was like, no, dude, you got to read this script. So he read it in one sitting at 3 a.m. And, you know, he's like, you know, I read so many horror scripts that a lot of the time you read stuff and you're like, OK, we've seen this before, like blah, blah, blah. But straight away with this film, he was like, I felt a sense of empathy and a sense of stake to the story with this kid, this horror version of the boy in a plastic bubble. So he was like, sure, yeah, I'll do that. He did make a few contributions to the script, uncredited, of course. The visual idea of the breath was his idea. Word Eli becoming lie and lie becoming code 317, that was his idea.
That's good, yeah.
The ghost fight where they're pulling Eli into the decontamination chamber, that was his idea.
Oh, that is one of my favorite sequences in this film.
Really, I think I do actually think he directs this pretty well. Will confess, I saw a lot of critiques about the overuse of jump scares in this movie. Most of the scares are of the jumpy variety, but I didn't think it was like overdone.
No, I mean, I feel like it's just code for exhausted film critics who are tired of watching the same thing in too many horror films. But at the same time, I don't think that this film is using too many of them. It's just, yeah, its principal mode of scares is it's got probably about 6 to 10 of them.
Yeah. But yeah, so in October of 2017, Paramount Pictures announced it had acquired its first screenplay for its Paramount Players label to go into production. And that was Eli, and they had scheduled it to be released in theaters on January 4th, 2019. Now, Paramount Players was founded in June of 2017, so like 3 or 4 months before they announced all this. The intent of this branch was to focus on contemporary properties while working with other Paramount Global brands. So one of the first films they released, they did a Madea film. They did that Taraji P. Henson, What Men Want, that Dora the Explorer live action movie. But then on the horror side, they did Paranormal Activity Next of Kin, Orphan First Kill, Smile, Significant Other, and Pet Sematary Bloodlines. This year they also did the Mean Girls musical.
Okay, interestingly enough, folks, we actually have multiple episodes on those properties. So again, plugging the Patreon because we have crossed 300 hours over there.
Oh my
10
god,
bucks,
god,
300 hours.
That's what happens when you podcast for 6 years, Joe.
Well, this is true. I just feel like people always look at it and say, oh, that's a lot of money for not a lot of content. It's like, folks, 300 hours, 10 bucks.
Yeah, exactly. So they start filming in January of 2018. I'll go to the filming in a bit because I have to talk about what happened with this fucking movie. So,
oh, okay.
December of 2018, the movie shot and filmed. Paramount sold all global rights for Eli to Netflix. They did this exact same thing with the Cloverfield Paradox where they dumped that after the Super Bowl.
Right.
Now, this is what Deadline said at the time. The thing with Eli is that it wasn't an expensive movie at an estimated $11 million budget. What occurred, we hear, is that the picture's champion, former Paramount Players head Brian Robbins, left to run Nickelodeon. And in the wake of that, the Paramount marketing team could not wrap their heads around selling Eli despite great test scores. And that is just too long, didn't read. They didn't know how to market this movie.
Yeah, but I mean, the early part of the sentence is also it lost its champion. And we often see that, you know, I'm thinking of a couple of titles we've covered where something has sat on the shelf when companies merge or get bought over. And people say, oh, well, it's been sitting there for so long, it must be a garbage movie. And it's like, no, it got lost in the shuffle. Or in this case, it lost its champion.
That's the thing, too. I mean, that really, really, really is shitty because I could could see this playing gangbusters with a theatrical crowd. Again, just because of that ending.
Well, and the other issue that we've often noted around things that go straight to streaming is that they just appear without any kind of fanfare. So I don't even think, and you're going to tell me if I'm wrong, but I don't think this movie really even did a festival circuit. So there was no opportunity to build buzz, and suddenly it's just on Netflix.
Yeah, so it lost that theatrical release date of January 4th, 2019. It just gets dropped on Netflix on October 18th, 2019. So it gets delayed by, 9 months and just jumped on Netflix. So,
and like, I get it. Sure, release a horror film in October on Netflix, it's probably going to do okay, but that is a long delay. So it's got zero momentum, no heat, no awareness.
Exactly. So critical reception was mixed. We're looking at a 48% on Rotten Tomatoes with an average score of 5.1 out of 10. And
come on.
Letterboxd users have given it a 4.8 out of 10. I settled on a 6 out of 10, a 3 out of 5 for this. I might be persuaded to push it up to a 3.5, but I think I'm good with my 3.
Okay. Yeah, I'm sitting at a 3.5. I think this is solid. It's definitely enjoyable. Watching it a second time, I was like, ready to just jump ahead to the end because it's so bonker.
I think that's the thing, is like, a lot of the second act of this movie is kind of like tropey ghosts in a haunted house type things, because most of this movie takes place in a single location. And I think that's the thing. I think there are some really cool like shots and stuff with the ghosts in that second act. But at the end of the day, like, I'm like, okay, like, you're really trying to hold off revealing the twist ending of this movie. And I think you really start to feel it in that transition between acts.
Yeah. And we should note, this is a nice big old house and we're using a fair portion of it, but you're not wrong. This is definitely a, okay, spin your wheels, play with the ghosts for a little bit before we can really get to the fun stuff.
And that's the only reason I don't rank it higher than a 3. But speaking of that house, so it was a hard challenge to find a house because they looked everywhere. They filmed this in New Orleans, Louisiana, and they wanted to find something gothic and old. Well,
sure.
That doesn't really exist a ton in New Orleans, because you're going to get a lot of plantation homes.
Oh, interesting. Because, yeah, you said New Orleans, and I thought, oh, cool, there's probably a dime a dozen because that city is so fucking spooky. But, yeah, it is going to be plantation shit, isn't it?
Yeah. So, to find something that was maybe a little older, a little more gothic, that just wasn't going to happen. Well, Foy saw a picture of a jail called the Beauregard Parish Correctional Facility in the town of DeRidder, Louisiana. And I had to look this up because I've never heard of this town, which is, I'm from Louisiana. This town is right on the Texas-Louisiana border. It's about 3 hours away from Houston, Texas, but 4 hours away from New Orleans. And the second Foy saw this correctional facility, he was like, oh my God, that's the house. So he and his production designer drove to this house, 4 hours away. And they were like, oh my God, we have to do this. Unfortunately, the producers were like, that's 4 hours outside New Orleans. We can't do that. We need to do it near our own stages. And Foy was like, well, we had a really tight budget. And I was like, it's $11 million. I mean, that... but whatever. I'm not going to presume to know like how they spend this money. What they ended up doing, though, they took complete inspiration from this correctional facility and from that building in a field. They built the stairs going up to the door, and then they built the door. They built the archway. They built the two windows on either side of the bottom floor. They had a chunk of a real house, and then the rest of it came together because of their visual effects team. So they took a lot of scans of the jail, and they were able to make it bigger than the jail actually is. So the final product, it's about 3/4 digital effects work and 1/4 like actual sets, but all of the takes were done on an actual location.
Oh, that is so interesting. I feel like I haven't really heard about that sort of combination. Like, you hear about them saying, okay, we look to find something like an actual full location set that we can use. I'm thinking of Stoker, and that one was like, we're just going to do this house and we're going to make it work with what we needed to do. You also hear about the variation of that, right? Where we like this thing and then we rebuild it because then we can manipulate it the way we want to, but not like half and half.
Yeah, that's movie magic though, right? Like, I almost want to watch it again to see if I can spot the digital effects of the sets at least.
Yeah, because as you were saying it, I realized, okay, yeah, some of this does feel like it's not really there, but I guess I attribute it to the spooky ghostiness of it all.
Yeah, I mean, if you had to go through and, like, you know, mark each location, it's mostly the same kind of hallways and the same bedrooms.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Okay. Well, it works. I think it works.
I agree. I think Foy accomplishes, like, a pretty foreboding atmosphere with this mansion. So, yeah, I love the set here. It's great.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, so why don't we talk about what happens in this movie? I'm surprised we haven't given away the ending yet, but I'm really excited.
You know what? We're trying to get people, if you haven't, just stop and go watch
just stop.
It and come back. Okay. So before we dig in, I'm going to give credit to Christy Pushko's piece in Pajiba called The Hidden Queer Horror Subtext of Netflix's Eli, which is where I'm going to draw all of my references from this. So we open on an 11-year-old Eli Miller, who is played by Charlie Shotwell, and I'm just going to say, 11 is the cusp of puberty, so keep that in the back of your mind as we move forward.
All right, done deal.
And Eli is running outside in front of his oblivious parents, who are, you know, a distance off. They're kind of not fully visible. So clearly this is a dream sequence or a nightmare, as we see, because his photosensitivity burns him up. This child just, you know, completely gets disfigured and he's screaming for help and they don't come and help him at all. And then he wakes up and he is immediately calmed by his mother, Rose, who is played by the wonderful Kelly Riley. Yeah. I had forgotten she was in this, and I was delighted.
She's done so much more horror than I thought. Like, I mean, like, I've seen her in plenty of things. Eden Lake, mm-hmm. of course. We talked about her yeah. last year on in A Haunting in Venice on the Patreon. Again, plug that Patreon, y'all. But, like, I think I just constantly hear about her because my parents, like, watch that Yellowstone show. And my dad yes. keeps trying to get me to watch it because he's like, mm-hmm. oh, my God, Trace, there's this bitch character in it. You will love her. And it's Kelly Riley.
It's her, yeah. And you're right. I do love her. I just... not sold on the show, but
I'm not sold.
I know it
on
has
show.
A huge fan base, so
yeah, I know.
So Rose is there, she's comforting him, and then we get ready for the day. So we are in a rundown Fleabag motel, and Eli is a little bit of a different kid, so he gets his clothes in sterile plastic bags. You know, we have to be really careful with him. And when we roll out of this room, he is fully in a hermetically sealed, you know, boy in the bubble style suit.
I really thought we were going to be getting more of this bubble.
I'm so glad we didn't, because it's interesting visually off the top. And then I'm like, no, please let this actor do his thing.
Absolutely. Now, I have a question for you. So, you know, you say you watched this with Terry when you were doing an event. Did you mm-hmm. know going into this movie that there was a twist?
Terry just told me that it was wild and that he thought I would like it.
Okay. So I will say, because I didn't spoil myself, but I did know mm-hmm. there was going to be a big reveal. Okay. I thought for sure we were doing vampires.
Oh, interesting. Which, of course, is what Abigail is.
Well, that's the thing. Honestly, okay, so you're going to laugh at me. There is a Goosebumps episode and book called Vampire Breath, where...
Of course there is.
Okay, so it's basically these two kids, a brother and a sister. Their parents are like, they're like night workers. They work at like a hospital or something. And mm-hmm. the kids find a secret passage that leads into this like cave beneath their house. And they awaken a vampire. The vampire tries to kill them, blah, 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 blah. The end of the story, the parents come home right as the vampire is about to kill the kids. And the mom okay. just goes... Dad? And it's like they're an entire family oh. of vampires. The kids are about to like puberty themselves into vampirism, and sure. that's the twist.
So, nice.
I thought we were doing that. I thought we were just adapting Vampire Breath when I was watching this.
I mean, and you would be forgiven because it is a bit of a tale as old as time, right? Like, there's only so many derivations of this that we can tell. Because your other obvious route is, okay, if it's not real, then maybe this is like a Munchausen by proxy thing.
Yeah.
Or, you know, like, there's very clearly something not quite right. And it's just a question of, is it the parents in the know or is it just Dr. Horn?
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, I also thought for sure Sadie Sink's character was a hallucination.
Right. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry. Mm-hmm. I'm jumping ahead. Go ahead.
No, you're fine. You're fine. So we're also introduced to his father, Paul, who is played by Max Martini from what, Trace? Revenge!
I don't even remember him in that show because he was in 7 episodes. But you know mm-hmm. what? More representation for Revenge, everyone. Go watch that shit.
Always and forever. Yes.
Always and forever.
I'm not going to lie. I definitely thought that this was James Badge, whatever his name is, This is a very familiar looking face, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I actually thought this was Kevin McKidd from Dog Soldiers and Grey's Anatomy.
Okay, yeah. He'd be suppressing that accent real hard if it was.
Well, I mean, this is not an American cast. Kelly Riley's definitely British. Kevin, the director of this film, is Irish. Kevin McKidd is Scottish.
Right, yeah. For reference, Kevin McKidd's not in this movie.
But no, he's not in this movie, everyone. Yeah. I just like Kevin McKidd.
There we go. We've established. Okay. So, yeah, we're checking out of this hotel. We're getting fleeced by this manager because we're 3 minutes over time. And we're setting the stage. You know, we're doing a bit of a road trip. We're low on funds or else we'd be staying somewhere nicer. Or we're hiding something, right? We're staying off the beaten path and so on.
Yeah. But I do like this, though, because I feel like for the first 30 minutes of this movie, it doesn't – you don't – I mean, obviously, you know you're watching a horror movie because you probably saw the genre on Netflix, but it doesn't feel like if you just started this blind, you wouldn't know you were watching a horror movie.
Right. Yeah. You think you're watching a sick kid family drama.
Yeah.
Like, I've seen this YA film in a different version, for sure.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So immediately, Eli is coded as different, though, because we've got a bunch of trashy D-bag kind of guys who are sitting in this parking lot and they see a kid in a bubble, more or less, and they start making fun of him. They let their dog bark at him and he gets so perturbed by this that he ends up falling and he skins his knee, which means, oh shit, we've opened up this suit. And we immediately get this glimpse of his face starting to, you know, burn and peel like we saw in his nightmare.
Yeah, this thing. So we at least know, hey, this is not a fluke. Like, he is, like, something is happening to this kid physically when he is exposed to the outside world.
Yes.
These, I cannot believe, like, these men making fun of this kid in a hazmat suit. Like, and they don't let up. They don't, honestly.
No.
When they back up into the, I think, one of the chairs, I was like, just roll these fuckers over.
You know what? Mass casualties in the side of this Fleabag motel, and I'm not bothered by it. Yeah, they do not get what's coming to them, but they are absolutely dicks.
Well, they probably will eventually. I would have taken like
oh, like a post-credit scene where Eli circles back around.
Yeah, or like when they're driving away, like you just see Eli like close his eyes and think, and then we just cut to these men and they all like immolate.
It'd be enjoyable, yeah.
It'd be fine.
Okay, so when he is panicking over the rip in his suit, we do get the first of many different iterations of Mom Rose using this breathing calming technique. So, you know, it's close your eyes, slow your breath, make a wish.
Make a wish.
And we use that to say, okay, now you're fine. You're going to be okay. And this is when he does say, you know, he wishes he could beat up these men and he hopes that the doctor is going to cure him. And I'm going to bring in Pushko right off the top here. So okay. She says, Eli's mother clearly knows these symptoms tie to his mood, which is why she coaches him through calming exercises instead of doing something rational, like pulling out an EpiPen. And this is why she urges him away from a violent wish to pay back the bullies who laugh at him. Because, of course, if his powers manifest according to his emotion, she needs to keep him calm. So she can't have him advocating for violence because it might trigger him, incite the turn.
Yeah. And actually, this whole thing kind of bleeds into an issue that I have with the movie is that it almost is another variation of, oh, one person sees things and everyone else thinks they're crazy, even though they don't. They know what's going on. But right. It's kind of that thing where I was like, yeah, I have seen a lot of this kind of stuff before.
But here's the thing, right? If you look back in hindsight at the film, you realize everyone is in on this except for Eli. Everybody else knows what's going on.
Well, but there's layers to it, though, because Rose knows what Eli is, but her husband lies to her about the possibility of him dying in these procedures.
This is true. Okay. Trace, I feel like we're not going to make it much further without spoiling the end. Should we just come clean about what this movie is dealing with?
Yeah. Okay, everyone. So basically, Kelly Riley was a sad non-mom who could not have a kid. She prayed to God to have a kid. He didn't answer her. So she turned to Satan and he gave her a kid.
Indeed. And then lied to her about it because said, the child will not be like me, but the child actually does have powers, could turn evil, and so on. So yes, we are going to see a doctor to try to cure whatever this child is. The child is different, Trace. The child has powers, but also the child is queer.
Yes, well, I'm sure the fact that he's a Satan child has a lot of ties into that. But we also learn throughout this process that Eli is not the only one of his kind. A lot of people have made deals with the devil to have babies, and they are all over the world.
I'm just saying, the first omen, the omen. We be doing this a lot.
So much. It's really weird. Like, how the, again, like, yeah, that we programmed this right after we've seen the first omen, right after we've seen Immaculate. And it's like, yeah, a lot of women went, well, in this one, wanting to have a baby. In this other movies, not wanting to have babies.
Truly. Yeah. a lot of religion putting its hands on women's bodies. We'll put it that way.
Very much so. Yes.
Hmm. Okay, yes. So we back up into the possessions of these delinquent men. We drive away. And as we pull out of the parking lot, Trace, did you catch that there's a billboard advertising something or other? But we've got Proverb 19:9 in here, which corresponds to a false witness will not go unpunished, and whoever pours out lies will perish.
Oh, really religious listeners, let us know if you picked up on that, actually, because I totally missed that.
Yeah, like it just has Proverb 19:9 amidst some other stuff. I think it's for like a Christian radio station or a church or something like that, but it's understated. So it's just giving you the numbers. And then I had to go and look it up and I was like, selective. I like it. You chose well.
Yeah, I just wonder, I mean, again, because like, there are people out there who can, like, you know, they'll see a Bible verse, like, written down, and they're like, oh, yeah, I know that from memory. Like, boom, I can tell you exactly what that is. So I wonder if this is a particularly more well-known Bible verse. But yeah, it absolutely does apply to the theme that the film is dealing with.
Yeah, we chose this one deliberately based on what the plot is.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we're driving along the road. We get a little bit of exposition about how we're going to see this expensive doctor. And then as we're driving, we do get this brief glimpse of Haley, who is played by Netflix regular Sadie Sink, as she is sitting on a swing. And then we're pulling up at this foggy mansion.
Which is 3/4 digital and 1/4 not.
There we go. Point out the digital, point out the not. Go on. Tell us.
I will say there's a part when they're driving there where they like the car has like a little bit of trouble. And I wrote in my notes, Chekhov's car trouble. Nope.
Doesn't come into play.
Doesn't come back.
So you know what? Not Chekhov then. Hey.
Not Chekhov. I know. It just
because people get mad at us when we say it all the time. So we pull up at this house, and I do love the kind of disconnect between the old spooky looking exterior, and then it's super automated, right? So Eli goes in first, and he goes through a decontamination, super high tech, you know, glowing buttons kind of space, and then he's admitted into the house.
Which, don't, because this is all for show.
Well, yes.
I mean, unless
we're already pumping shit into the air to try to, like, get it into him.
I was going to say, like, maybe it's blessed air.
Right, yes. it's ode to Jesus. So on the other side, he is greeted by Dr. Horn. This is Lily Taylor, as well as her two nurses, Barbara, Deneen Tyler, and Maricela, who is played by Katia Gomez. And of course, your spidey sense should tingle when these two nurses are told to go and get the luggage from the car, and they both kind of shoot Eli this kind of look.
I think Lily Taylor is probably the most fascinating part of this movie to me because she does...
She's great.
She simultaneously makes you feel so, like, at ease and at home, but then in the same breath, you're like, ooh, you're evil. Like, you're an evil person. But, spoiler alert, she's not.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think she's like the best villains, where she truly does believe in what she's doing. She thinks she's on the side of right, and for all intents and purposes in this film, if you side with Eli, then she is an antagonist.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say, though, I mean, like, but technically Eli is an antagonist. He's just an unwilling one.
I would say anti-hero, but yes.
Yeah, sure.
You always do this. Antagonist is in proximity to a protagonist, so you need to have a protagonist to have an antagonist.
Right. It's removed from good and evil. It's just, it's in the context of the story we are watching.
Yeah, that's why I like him as an anti-hero, because... At the end of the film, well, I mean, we can debate, is it even a bad thing that he is the son of the devil? Because I would say, using the parameters of this film, he is not, because he only hurts people who were trying to hurt him.
But as Dr. Horn will say later, you haven't done anything wrong, but you will, because the way this film ends, it's kind of like, okay, yeah, we're mobilizing an army of Satan's children.
Yeah, but she's also a religious bigot. Like, her definition of bad could be completely different from what society deems.
Didn't we just watch The Omen together this month?
I'm just saying, that movie definitely codes it as like, oh, you're going to bring about the destruction of humanity, whereas this is one religious lady saying, oh, you're going to do some bad stuff, but I'm not going to elaborate.
Well, I mean, that is the other thing, too. I'm like, we should have told this kid what was going on from the get-go. I get why they don't, but whatever.
Truly. Like, try to move him towards the side of good. Yeah, you're going to have powers, but maybe you can use those in a productive way. No, no,
no, that's not what happens with it. No, he's Satan's child.
I'm just saying, what's so bad about Satan?
Look at the last 10, what happened to these people in the last 10 minutes of this movie?
They fucking deserved it. This is a queer rage revenge story.
Yeah.
Okay. So Dr. Horn and Eli initially have a fairly good relationship because Eli is a smart kid. He knows about his disease. This impresses the doctor as we go about a tour of this house.
Which I love it. We talked about geography of our sets a lot. I don't really think we get that here because, again, we don't explore like this enormous house enough to do it. But it's fine, a way to get to know the characters.
Yeah, you mostly have an understanding of like, okay, bedrooms are upstairs, treatment is down on the main level, and then we discover, oh, there's secret basements and a couple of offices. But yeah, if you told me draw where her office is on the ground floor, could not tell you.
No idea.
No. So while we're doing this walk and talk tour, though, Eli does ask her the question, you know, like, we learn that she has had other patients, and he says, you know, so you cured them, and she dodges this question. She's like, yeah, definitely helped other people, other patients.
Well, and that's the thing, because by the end of the movie, she says, like, well, you're going to die, but we will save your soul, which for Christians and especially Catholics, that's the most important thing, because your life on earth is just a brief gift. It's the everlasting life of your afterlife that's important. So she does think that even though she's literally killing these kids, she is saving their souls from damnation.
Literally that. I think she even says, like, I'm going to save your soul as she's preparing the dagger in the climax.
Yes, she is.
Curing? Not so much. Nothing can be done about this.
I mean, we're curing you of life.
Sure. Yes. We are unaliving you in an effort to save your soul.
Your illness is actually the fact just being alive. That's your illness.
Yeah, exactly. But we do get a couple of sort of fake-out deflections here. So we get a strange rumbly creak, and we attribute that to the house. So initially, early on, you might even be convinced, oh, this is going to be a spooky house story, hence ghosts and other things.
Yes, which I do like the misdirect with that, because, again, I mean, it still is a ghost story. The ghosts are real, even though they will tell Eli many times, you're just hallucinating because of the treatments.
Yeah. Oh, I love that old adage. Trace, we also have a blocked-off, non-clean section of the house, which we cannot go into because it is not safe.
Yes. So, okay. Why? Like... with the movie we have now, before we know what's actually going on, this makes sense. But with the reveal of what's actually going on, I don't understand why this is closed down.
So this goes unsaid, but when I was reflecting on this, because I had the same thought, I even wondered, do we ever break into the non-clean part of the house? I couldn't recall. But I think, this is my takeaway, I think that this is a measure of control. So we're trying to basically keep Eli contained within only specific parts so that he's easier to keep track of. Because halfway through the film, when he almost gets out of the decontamination section, I thought, why don't they have someone posted? Why isn't there a guard or an orderly or something? And it's all to give this illusion that, no, this is just a medical house. Like, this is your house, as she tells him. Yeah. So I think this is the illusion that Eli is actually free to move about, but actually we're controlling him to just within a couple of hallways and rooms.
Okay, you know what? I can buy into that.
It's all we've got. The movie doesn't want to explain it any further. So we end up in his new room, and he and Mom Rose have this nice cry as they remove his suit, and they're very excited. You know, there's a lot of promise and potential here. This is going to change all of their lives. He's going to get better. And later in bed, Rose says as much to Paul. So she says, you know, she's looking forward to being happy again. And she says, it's what I prayed for. And we just have this image of Paul not looking as optimistic, but he doesn't say anything. And you realize, as he will say later, well, I'm not sure that praying's going to do anything.
That's something I'm missing from this movie. Again, we don't have time by the time it's revealed, which is why this is a movie where I really would have liked it if the twist would have happened at the end of the first act instead of the last 10 minutes of the movie. Because I actually would love to see the conversation between Paul and Rose where he's like, you prayed to Satan to get us a son.
Yeah, I don't want flashbacks to see how it all came together, but it's interesting the kinds of things that you can pick up, because even on the first watch, but definitely on the second rewatch for the pod, I was getting big stepdad energy from this guy. Uh-huh. I was like, I can't figure out why, because they're saying that this is his father, and it's not until you get to the end you realize, oh, no, this is stepfather energy.
Yeah, it's not even his real son. But yeah, I think there's a much more interesting movie where this is the premise of the film and not the twist ending.
Yeah, I mean, I would love it if we could maybe move away from films and TV shows that are so reliant on twists, because they often feel like they need to put it in either the last act, the last episode, or what have you, and just say, I'm going to hit the audience with this, you know, two episodes in to our 10-episode run, or at the end of the first act, as you're suggesting.
And, you know, I don't even think there's an issue with a twist per se, if it's like recontextualizing the rest of the film before. But when this twist happens, I have a lot more questions that can't be answered because we kill everyone.
Yeah, well, I mean, because we're building to this big, exciting, maybe cathartic ending, but it doesn't leave us any time to have a denouement or unpack anything.
Right, yeah.
Because nobody wants the movie to keep going. It's like, oh, we ended on a high. Okay, credits. Let's go.
Well, you mean you don't want to see the sequel tease where they make it to their destination and meet a whole bunch of other Satan kids and just, like, hug or something?
Oh, I think it'd be fun. I mean, again, if this movie had gone theatrical and maybe made a bit of money, we could have discussed it. But again, the pitfalls of going direct to streaming is often we don't get sequels to these films.
Yeah. Also, I think that's a trend with those blacklist scripts, too. You know, like, it can be a relatively generic film for most of it. But then if you have that big twist, blacklist it.
Yes. And again, folks, if you don't understand the blacklist, that's a good thing. You want to end up on the blacklist.
Yeah. I feel like a lot of times, though, like most of the time, blacklist scripts don't wind up making the best movies. Like I feel like they never really match the promise of the script. But again, that's an execution thing, right?
Yeah. It's what can you do with the written word when you turn it into a visual medium? And I think some people have got it. And then other times you end up with Jodie Foster's The Beaver.
Oh, I thought The Beaver. I mean, Mel Gibson aside, I thought The Beaver was fine. I can't believe you. I'm sorry. Out of all the movies you could have referenced.
It's just my go-to, because I was like, why did this movie of all titles end up on the blacklist? Because when you see that film, you're like, this is just eh.
Okay. It's because the gimmick. It's just that it's that puppet. That's all it is.
Sure. But I think that's the other big thing about the blacklist titles is that they do often end up having this one weird, quirky, cool hook. But then again, does that turn into a good movie? I think it's a better read.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
Yeah. Okay. So I will confess, I don't think that the CGI effects are good on whatever this thing is that he sees throughout the film, because I couldn't tell if it's a moth or a dragonfly.
Oh, I thought it was a mosquito hawk.
Oh, I don't even. Oh,
okay. Oh, you're not from the. Did they not have those in Canada?
I mean, we have mosquitoes. I don't know what the other part of that word was.
Here, it's a hawk. H-A-W-K. Google mosquito hawk right now. They look like giant mosquitoes, but we were always told as kids, don't kill them because they actually kill mosquitoes.
Okay, bitch, this is a dragonfly. It literally says mosquito hawk, a night hawk, a dragonfly.
Okay, whatever. It's a subset of a dragonfly. It's because if you compare a mosquito hawk to what we know as a dragonfly, it's not the same fucking thing.
Okay. At least we're on the same sort of general page in terms of, yes, this is what we think it is. And it's going to work into my queer reading, which is why I'm excited, because this is me crediting Wikipedia, you know, the opus of great research techniques. According to Wikipedia, there is male homosexuality that has been inferred in several species of dragonflies. So the fact that we've got this little gay
mosquito hawk.
Yes, or mosquito hawk floating around, guiding our queer youth to find answers and so on. It's like, find your destiny. Come out.
So do, okay, that makes a lot more sense because I think when the movie ended, I had forgotten all about this dragonfly sure. mosquito hawk. And
because it's never explained and nobody else ever talks about it.
Exactly. So, you know, I mean, okay, do you think, though, the symbolism there was intentional on their part or was it just like a red herring or a drop plot thread?
I truly don't know because Christie's piece is the only piece of queer media criticism on this film. Like, this movie did not get a ton of reviews overall. Yeah. It has virtually no think pieces, but Christie's is like the only one that has anything to say about queerness. She doesn't talk about this. I was just more like, perplexing. Why do we have this one choice of insect in the film? And I look it up and I'm like, huh, maybe it was intentional then.
You know what? If not, damn good job convincing us so.
Sure, because like how often do you see a dragonfly in movies? It's like a very specific choice.
Oh my god. I feel like there's a Kevin Costner movie called Dragonfly.
Oh, you know what? I think you're right.
But that's it. That's it.
We are 6 degrees of Kelly Reiling this bitch up and down tonight. That's all I'm saying.
Also, yes, 2002's Dragonfly starring Kevin Costner and Kathy Bates.
Okay, that is a cast. That is weird.
It was panned by critics and was a box office bomb.
Cool. Let's seek it out. Somebody tell us if it's any good.
I don't know.
Okay. So in the morning, Dr. Horn clarifies that, yes, hallucinations are a side effect of his medication. So if he's seeing weird breathing on the windows, that's from the meds. If you're seeing ghost children, that's from the meds. If you're getting dragged down the hall into the decontamination room, that's the meds.
Sure. This kid doesn't believe any of that shit.
Mm-hmm. So it's time for our first treatment, and he has to go in alone, Trace. So he makes a breathing wish that he's going to be strong. Wish I was strong. It's like, don't worry, kid. By the end of the film, you'll find your strength. So we go into this examining room, and I'm not going to lie, it looks very similar to a morgue.
Yeah. Well, there's a dungeon downstairs, so it's fine.
Truly, this house has it all. It's like House Hunters International came calling, and they were like, I need a dungeon. I need a crucifix dagger. I need a table that I can perform like medical experiments on in the shape of a cross.
I need a jail cell that has a well, but it's not a well. It's just a place where I can store dead bodies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I'm telling you, this has everything except for modern appliances. So he gets weighed, he gets photographed, and then he gets strapped face down on the examinee.
Oh, I've got another clue for you. So when they're weighing him, the one of the assistants says, seis, 66. So that's, he's 66 pounds, but she says the seis first. So she says 666. Yeah.
Oh, shit.
Mm-hmm.
It's about to get devilish in here.
God, there's so much. April's just the devil's month, I guess. Devil and children.
There we go. You know what? New theme unlocked. So we should also note that this movie has possibly the second most striking surgical scrub outfits I've seen in a movie, following Dead Ringers.
I would say Dead Ringers.
These purple paisley, I mean, folks, I'm not in fashion, so you know what color I'm talking about. They're impressive. They're interesting. They're unique.
They're unique. Yeah, the purple is very much tied to Catholicism, too.
Oh, is it? Okay. Mm-hmm. So Dr. Horn explains that she's going to inject a virus into his bone marrow, and it's going to reset his system like a magic trick, to which I thought, okay. I mean, again, she's trying to speak his language because we learn that he's interested in magic and, you know, performing magical feats. And I mean, I guess I just love how much of this foreshadows, like, yeah, you're going to be able to perform magic as well. You're going to be able to light shit on fire all over this movie.
I just also, because he's asking these questions and she's like, do you know what happened to the boy who asked too many questions? He just goes, he got answers.
So sweet. What a naive baby angel. Yeah.
There's this Friends episode where Reese Witherspoon plays Rachel's sister.
Right.
She's doing all this stuff because she's going to date Ross or whatever. And Rachel's like, Jill, do you know what happened to the girl who did too much too fast? No. Well, she died, Jill.
Just deadpan. As opposed to the same thing that happened to everyone else.
Right.
Also my favorite answer to that.
I remember being fucking 11 years old watching X-Men in the theater and being like, that was a terrible response to that question.
Absolute clunker of a line that I can't believe it. No one excised from that script. Blacklist script, it was not. Okay, so let's inject this child in the side cheek and let's cut into him with a scalpel and let's get that bone punch going.
The way we are poking and prodding this kid without any hesitation, like this is a part later where she just injects him with stabs him with the syringe. I was like, oh boy.
Because he's not a person. He's something that they just need to control, that they need to exercise, right?
Okay, so I will be on this ride with you for this queer reading. I just don't know how much I love, like, yes, okay, because Christianity views queerness as a sin, you know, sent from the devil, blah, 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 blah. But then there's still the part of me that's like, okay, but like, you know, me growing up religious, like, but hell is bad, heaven is good, Satan is bad, God is good. Oh my God. I don't know if I love this linking of legitimate evil Satan with queerness, even though I get that that's what, like, they think about us.
Yeah. I mean, in Chrissy's reading, she's not arguing, oh, and this is like an awful conflation because we're saying queerness equals, you know, devilish or satanic or something. She's looking at the way that they approach his disease is the same as how you might approach conversion therapy.
Thank you for that clarification. That makes more sense.
In fact, here, let me pull her back in. Horn assaults Eli's body when he experiences the stress symptoms. So like when his face gets blotchy and irritated, he's having these reactions. And throughout the film, we're repeatedly told, oh, it's either a symptom of the medication, it's the way your body is reacting to it, or it's, you know, you manifesting symptoms from your disease. But of course, we'll learn later on that these are stress symptoms. So we're activating this in him because he's scared or he's upset or something like that. That's why he gets splotchy.
Which, okay, because that's the thing, right? Because we're led to believe that, okay, if he is exposed to the outside air, that he's going to flare up. You know, that's the boy in the plastic bubble thing. But
yeah,
we learn, yeah, it's these stress reactions or his powers coming into effect. But isn't the thing, though, he's only stressed out because they are telling him, hey, if you step outside, this will happen to you, which it's like self-fulfilling prophecy.
Absolutely that, yeah. So Rose has conditioned him to have this reaction, again, so that she can control him. And, you know, it's the best way to negotiate that by saying, okay, well, when you do this, you have this reaction. But she's the one who's basically encouraging him to develop that. And then she gives him the strategy to cope so that he comes to rely on her more. In a way, it actually is kind of Munchausen
by proxy. It's kind of Munchausen by proxy.
Okay, so sorry, coming back to Chrissy's quote here. So, you know, she assaults him, he experiences these stress symptoms, and then she tells him the agony he feels is because of his feelings and not the abuse that she is knowingly putting him through. So this mirrors some real-life accounts of gay conversion therapy where horrendous physical torture was intended to make the victim associate their homosexual desires with pain. So it's like every time you want to start manifesting your powers, you have these reactions, and we code that as a bad thing. So instead of sexual desires, it's satanic powers.
Okay, you know what? I'm getting more on board with this. You're buttering me up.
Okay, so we have this horrendous reaction where Eli gets really, really upset because it's really, really painful. And then he blacks out. When he wakes up, he's back in bed. We don't see how he got there, but he's hooked up to an IV. He'll be hooked up to an IV for like 90% of the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
And this is where Haley shows back up. So she's throwing rocks at the window. You could say it's like a romantic kind of meet cute, but I'm going to argue she's the ally in this film. So she is trying to get him to a point where he can accept himself because she knows that he's being fed a shit ton of lies.
Well, also, if she was a love interest, they'd be incestual.
Well, yeah, there is that.
Yeah, I thought for sure this girl was his hallucination. Like, I did not think for a second she was going to be real. So I was happy to have that expectation subverted.
And I believe that's kind of what the movie expects you to think the first time around, because no other character interacts with her until way later in the film.
Yeah, the second Lily Taylor looks at her and goes, "You," I was like, "Oh,
oh, shit, real." Yeah, but again, we're planting some little seeds of doubt about Dr. Horn, because Haley says, "This place gives me the creep," and Dr. Horn seems shifty.
Yeah, and she doesn't like me.
Mm-hmm. But also, if you're reading this as a, ooh, well, can we trust this girl? We don't really know anything about her. You think, well, when she's saying that Dr. Horn is shifty, is she actually being shifty? So it's very much, who can you trust?
Yeah, I at least do appreciate in the end that he's like, you could have just told me. And she's like, yeah, but you had to figure it out. Sure, mm-hmm. movie. Okay, like, yeah, whatever.
It's a bit of a hand wave explanation, but also, I'm not mad about it.
No, it's, I feel like this movie does overtime to avoid giving the twist away, mm-hmm. and sometimes it annoys me more than not.
Yeah, we're on the hamster wheel to avoid actually getting somewhere.
Yeah.
Okay, so he says goodbye to Haley for the night, and he briefly gets this chase with this ghost girl. So this is the first time we actually get to see it. You know, we saw it briefly during the operation where he thought he saw something in the mirrored reflection, but this is the first, like, really good glimpse of it.
Is this when he's looking in that, like, through the glass window, mm-hmm. and it's the ghost girl is, like, part of the furniture, and then she all of a sudden, like, gets up?
Yes.
Ugh! So this is actually one of the best parts of the film for me, and I kind of hate that we're not able to match it, because I thought this was so cleverly done. It's really mm-hmm. creepy when she actually does sit up, too.
Yeah, and we're doing some really good shadow work, because, mm-hmm. you know, he gets scared, so he runs to another part of the hallway, and there's that kind of, like, it's like a barrier, but it's made of heavy plastic that's cut into slits, so you can walk by, but it'll sort of, like, control airflow. And I love that we get this silhouette shadow work where mm-hmm. it looks like a girl, and she looks like she's about to attack him, and then it's actually just his dad with the IV.
Yeah. Now, of course, again, this is one of those things where it's like, we think these ghosts are malicious and trying to hurt him or something, mm-hmm. but it's very much a, no, they're trying to get him out of the house.
Yeah, we're definitely back in What Lies Beneath territory, where it's like, hey, ghost, maybe just spell it out instead of just writing my name backwards.
Dude, the code. But why don't you just say, we're Satan's children, fucker?
Well, I guess it's like Haley says at the end, you know, you needed to work your way into it, because I couldn't just say it first thing. Would you have believed me?
Yeah, I don't buy into that, but whatever.
whatever.
It's fine.
Okay, so we have a dinner sequence. His parents clearly do not believe him, but then he ends up getting attacked again that night in his room. So this is where he's playing with the flashlight. He sees the silhouette of something in the curtains, but there's no feet. And then, he gets, like, fully grabbed, and it's very exciting. But again, it's like, oh, it's his dad something.
Yeah. This fun camera work here, because, you know, we have, like, you know, it's in this closet door, because the closet door is a mirror, and we're mm-hmm. we're doing, like, that medicine cabinet scare, but it's not really a scare. Yep. We're just kind of opening and closing it. The camera's doing a 360 spin. I thought all this was really well done, and I feel like it kind of, like, these scare tactics dip off in quality after these moments.
Yeah, because the hallway one that I really like is a different kind of scare. It's more sustained.
Right.
And I, again, think it is shot very well, because we like to see the ghosts in the mirrors, but we can't mm-hmm. see them otherwise. And I like that.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, this is still definitely when the jump scares are hitting.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But even, you know, having it be his dad a second time around, I was just like, oh, we're going back to this well? And we haven't even gotten to the well with the three bodies of the kids in it yet?
Mm. We're going back to this well, but not that well.
Yeah, this well, not that one. So, we're blaming the meds again. This is Dr. Horn's, she was just going to stay and toe this line the whole fucking movie.
He's going to get worse before he gets better.
He is going to get worse before he gets better. So let's do treatment number two. And we're into full Saw territory. We're shaving the back of this kid's head and just, like, sticking shit into his brain.
Oh, yeah. It is wild. Which, again, we'll learn at the end, they're just injecting him with holy water.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, like, plant-based stuff that basically the devil does not like.
It's like, okay. Yes, which I think I saw that they said Tannis root, but Tannis root That's actually an allusion to Rosemary's Baby, because Tannis Root was made up by that book's author, Ira Levin, for the story.
Oh, interesting. Okay. See, that's subtle. I didn't even catch that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, yeah, and again, I thought that was one of those things where it's like, oh yeah, that's what we do in movies. It's Tannis Root, sure. But so I don't know if it's been in other films besides Rosemary's Baby, but Rosemary's Baby, the book, coined that shit.
Started it.
Yeah.
Which is just so good, though, right? I mean, to me, that's pretty smart, because what's the hook of Rosemary's Baby, right? It's, yeah. Oh, I'm being gaslit by everybody, mm-hmm. and secretly I'm going to give birth to Satan's child.
And those are homages, or again, references that I think are good, because it's not cluing you into something. Like, you're not going to hear that and be like, oh my god, Rosemary's Baby. Oh my god, this mm-hmm. is a Satan movie. But it's subtle exactly. enough to where it works, I think.
Yeah, like, it would have been really easy, you know, to have made that 666 reference more obvious. Yeah. But instead, it's like, okay, it can sneak by and you might not catch it. This one might sneak by. You might not catch it.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, so we make it through number two, but it is even worse than number one, you know, as number one and number two often is. But no, I'm kidding. Take that out. That's a terrible joke.
I think I'm going to leave that in, honestly. Oh, boy. What are your number twos like?
So much worse. So Eli is not feeling well, but he does manage to make it to dinner. But his weakened state has him thinking back to what Haley said. So he voices it. He actually says, I think Dr. Horn is shifty. And if she's really treating him, then why does he feel so much worse? And of course, this is when Paul goes into overdrive and he says, you know, oh, well, fine. If you want to leave, then we can just fucking leave. But do you really want to do that, or do you want to stay and get better?
Reverse psychology.
Yeah, I put in my notes, this is macho bullshit. But to me, particularly if you are looking at this as a bit of a queer reading, this is giving off, don't be a fucking fairy.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, man up, don't be a pussy. Take your medicine, eat your vegetables, and get strong.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Paul is the character I want to know more about in this mm-hmm. film. Because, I mean, as you said, I get it. Like, he's the stepdad. But there's more tragedy to that. Again, like, I want to know, did Rose make this deal with the devil without him knowing, which is why he's being so cagey around her in this movie?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we really don't get an idea about, like, when she made the deal and what the depth of their relationship was. Like, is he firing blanks? And she was like, okay, well, I guess I'm going to have to turn to the devil, my other baby daddy. Or did they make an agreement and now he just feels resentful?
Yeah, that's a thing where if this wasn't a 11th hour twist, we could dive into those questions.
Ooh, you know, we're also talking about Late Night with the Devil on Patreon this month.
Oh my
this
God.
Is like open relationship with the devil.
Yes. God, man, we are really on a theme month.
April. Religion. Yeah, that's it. That's the end.
Yeah. You know, if Abigail's vampirism turns out to be because of a deal made with the devil, bam.
Oh my God.
Synchronicity.
In which case, then we just end everything and pledge our souls to Satan. Right?
I guess, like, so.
You just have to.
Oh my God, don't actually say that, because then it might happen.
You know what? My body is a vessel. Just take it.
It's one of those things. Like, so my husband's been making me watch a lot of these like ghost hunting shows, and I don't really buy into a lot of this stuff the same way I don't buy into a lot of like this religious stuff. But it's one of those mm-hmm. things where I'm so afraid of the possibility of these things being real that I will show them a reverence to not risk it. But I don't really believe it, but I'm open to the possibility of it actually existing.
Yeah. Yeah. You're not going to take the chance, because even if you don't really believe it in your soul, it's like, yeah, but if I believe in a soul, I don't want to jeopardize it.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Clearly not an issue for these kids in this movie. Okay, so let's talk about the big closet scene. So the lights go out, and where do we hide, Trace? But we hide in the closet.
In the closet. This is, again, I think this is a pretty good scene. This is when we start to kind of seeing, like, oh, we're doing the same kind of scare tactics as we just saw.
Mm-hmm.
It's still effective, though.
Yeah, yeah, it's not bad. You're right, I do think it's kind of, we're getting depreciating returns each time, but at least we're sort of shaking up the makeout. So, you know, one time it's just in the hall, one time it's in the bedroom, this time it's in an enclosed space. And then when we come out of the closet, ooh, we've written the word Eli, Eli, Eli about a billion times on this thing.
But you better believe that they're going to say something else later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, of course, everybody thinks that he did it because he does have a piece of broken glass from where the mirror shattered. So it's like, oh, it's just your meds. You're struggling with this. It's fine. Gaslighting to the extreme.
Yeah.
But Haley does give him a clue to work off of when he sees her the next night. She name drops Perry, a former patient who also saw ghosts. So not an isolated incident. And the last time she saw Perry was right before he went in for procedure number 3.
Bum, bum, bum.
That's true. Which, you know what? I mean, at least it wasn't like procedure number 5, because then I probably have to make a mumbo number 5 joke.
Moment number 5. But, yeah. But this is leading into one of the best sequences in the film, though, when they're, again, the one that Foy added in, where they're dragging him down this hallway.
Yeah, yeah. So he goes to investigate a noise, and all of a sudden it's like invisible hands grabbing him, dragging him down. He's screaming, and we get these fleeting shots, like tracking shots, as we go by mirrors, and we can see the ghosts are holding him. It's really effective.
Yeah, it's really well done. And I mean, honestly, kudos to Charlie Shotwell. Like, this is his first, like, big feature. He's done a couple things before this, but, like, this movie asks a lot of this 10-year-old kid.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And he delivers. Like, he's really convincing, especially in these scares, especially communicating pain when he has these reactions. And he gets real scared here because they do drop him in the decontamination room, and the door does start to open, and he is flipping the fuck out.
Yeah, so again, we think, oh my god, they're trying to kill him, but in actuality, it's like, no, they're trying to help him.
Yeah, we're trying to prove to you, you can actually be outside and you'll be fine, except you're stressed and you're having the adverse reactions that your mother has literally groomed into you.
Yeah, they couldn't just be like, just chill, it's fine, we promise, you won't die. They just have to just do it.
Yeah. I will say it's around this point where they try to once again convince him, no, it's just your meds. This is actually all you doing it. And he stops accepting this as an answer at this point in the film, which I was grateful for because I was ready to be done with it.
Well, because this is when Rose tries to do the make-a-wish thing again. And he's just like, I don't want to make a fucking wish.
Yep, he sure does. And then he faints.
Yeah.
But when he wakes up, he does overhear Paul and Dr. Horn talking about him. He can't quite make out what they're saying. And Rose is also eavesdropping, and she's not fully hearing what they're saying. But it's like, these two shouldn't have a real relationship, should they? Except we know that Paul is the one who actually found Dr. Horn, which, well, again, I think tells us something about the nature of his relationship to Eli and this pregnancy.
Absolutely. And I think, too, this is when you really start thinking, if Rose hasn't been involved, then he's probably been working with Dr. Horn for maybe longer than we think.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So we do decide we're going to give Eli diazepam to help him sleep, because in the morning we're going to move forward with treatment number 3. So Rose goes in to see Eli because she wants to make sure he's doing okay. And I like that she says, I do believe that you saw something, but I don't believe what you saw was real. So she's like, I'm willing to meet you halfway.
Yeah, which
you,
I mean, again,
like, believe you saw it.
The thing is, too, because Rose is in the dark right now. Like, she doesn't know the extent with which all this is happening. I guess arguably Dr. Horn doesn't know either. Like, do you think she knows that these ghosts are an actual thing?
It's a question mark. Yeah, she doesn't really ever end up interacting with them. I mean, I'm going to say no, because the movie doesn't tell us otherwise.
No, you know what, though? She says in the beginning that her other patients experience hallucinations. So I think she's just always chalked it up to hallucinations and not actual ghosts.
Right. Well, I mean, she's technically a doctor, as far as we know.
She's a nun.
A nun doctor? You can be both, Trace. God.
Okay. Her literally, the only thing she does is put holy water into veins.
Yeah, she knows her way around medical equipment.
I'm sorry, veins and brains. That's where she puts holy water.
Oh my god, she graduated from the top of her class from Brains and Veins University. Okay, so Rose is trying to reassure Eli, it's almost over. We've just got to get you through this final procedure. And she does say the line, if we didn't think you could go on to live a normal life, we wouldn't have brought you here. And I'm going to emphasize the word
normal. Yeah.
So I'll bring back in Christy. She says, buying into the same kind of rhetoric homophobes have spouted for generations, Rose suggests her son could not have a normal life as he is. Beyond this, she never considered if her conception of a normal life, in quotations, is even what her son wants. At this point, her love for Eli is about who she desires him to be, not who he is.
Yeah, that is the thing. So going back to my earlier point about like conflating, you know, queerness with like Satan children, all that aside, you're right. Like they should be like, they should be front with him and be like, hey, this is what you are. What would you like to do about that, if anything?
Right. As opposed to saying, no, you're not that, or, ooh, you know, you are different, but we want you to try to be normal. Like, this emphasis on you need to fit in, you need to be what the majority is, in a queer situation, so fucking harmful, right? Because you telling me that I need to be normal is actually just denying what I actually am, and it's making it harder for me to be true to myself.
Yeah, absolutely.
So they hug, and this is when Eli, from the position of their hug, realizes, oh, Eli could also be the word lie, but it could be 317 as well.
Yeah, because he's in that closet scene from earlier, or like something, he sees Eli written in the fog, but then the E gets wiped out and rewritten after the L-I, which is kind of cool. But yeah, but also, okay, I'm sorry, what top secret facility door has a three-digit code?
Oh, absolutely not. It's like, it needs to be 4, it needs to be 5, it needs to be 25.
This is where I thought it was going to be a Bible verse. I thought we were going to get a Bible verse.
Oh, interesting. Now I'm wondering, are there significant Bible verses that are aligned to 317?
Yeah, Eli is a biblical figure, but it's not a book in the Bible. Oh, but well, I was going to say, though, there is a movie called The Book of Eli.
Yes, there is.
Not very related. Different premise.
Okay, so we get not quite a montage, but he spits out the pill. We get to see the parents not facing each other on the bed. And we get this very fun image of Dr. Horn casually burning a backpack.
Oh, I thought she was burning his hazmat suit.
Oh, maybe that's what it is.
I mean, regardless, we'll say both. But yeah, because, and this is, again, you're like, well, what the fuck is going on with this bitch?
Yeah, the shiftiness is definitely escalating. So at dusk, Haley returns and she and Eli brainstorm 317. She's pretty quick to say, oh, it could be a code. And he catches her. But we just sort of say, oh, well, you know, I don't know. Like, what do you think it is? Is it a code? Could it be a code?
She's tipping the scale way too far. Daddy Satan's like, bitch, stop.
Yeah. Don't make me claw you back with a literal claw.
Maybe a claw coming out of a vagina.
Yeah. Sir, save that for Patreon, please.
I know. So, y'all go watch The First Omen.
Eli does investigate. He uses the code to access Dr. Horn's office. And I couldn't figure out if this is in the unsafe part of the house or not. He doesn't have any difficulty breathing, but at, you know, in a couple of scenes, he's going to accuse his mother of lying to him. So he does put it together.
Yeah, I thought it was the barred off place because it definitely gives West Wing vibes from Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah, like it's forbidden territory. You were never supposed to be in here. But regardless, he does end up finding records for some other people. And this is where we also see Paul confessing to Rose that there's a chance he may have over-exaggerated the cure rate / success.
Okay, I wrote in my notes, this is clearly news to her.
Yeah, because we're fighting so loud, we're waking up Dr. Horn, who's in a whole separate room, maybe a whole separate level.
Yeah, a whole separate wing.
So many wings.
The East Wing, the West Wing, the North Wing, the South Wing.
Yes, the Basement Wing.
The Basement Wing, the Cell Block Wing.
Yeah, so many wings. House Hunters International. Okay, so back in the lab or the office, Eli's looking through the records. He finds three other kids, and we get to watch them deteriorate throughout each of the treatments to the last treatment, number 3, and none of them survive.
No. Okay, this is a weird piece of trivia that I discovered. So the girl that plays Agnes, one of the patients, she is played by, I think we only see her in images. We don't even get to see like an acting role from her. But a woman, a girl named Kalia Lexis Posey. Now, this girl, she was best known for, she kind of broke out on Toddlers and Tiaras when she was a little kid. Oh. There's a gif that runs around the internet where it's like this girl, she has brunette hair, and she just smiles, but like folds her lips back into her gums, and it's like this really like, kind of like mischievous, innocent smile.
Oh, yeah, kind of like Damien. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So it's this girl, this is going to take a turn. She died by suicide in 2022.
Jesus.
Yeah.
I'm guessing at a not very old age because she's young.
Yeah, she would have been 16. But yeah, so she was in Toddlers and Tiaras as a contestant on 2010, 2011, and 2016. Her only acting role, again, quote unquote, is this movie. And yeah.
Wow. Okay. So. Yeah, I mean, I think we do get to see the ghost kids in those like mirror shots in the action, but right. I mean, they're indistinguishable. Like you wouldn't be able to tell them out of a lineup.
Yeah, I guess we see their red eyes every now and then, but like, yeah, we never get like a full on like close up shot of them.
Mm-mm. And definitely no dialogue or anything like
that. No.
So Eli gets properly freaked out by this. He does run upstairs to tell his dad what he saw. And I think it's super significant that when he runs into his room, we just see Paul smashing the dragonfly / mosquito hawk. It's like, I'm just killing your queerness. Hey, gay kid, smash.
Smash.
So, yeah, we try to say, you know, hey, this is what's going on. And Paul just drugs him immediately with a sedative.
I mean,
the nurses drag him away.
That's the thing is, like what, at this point, you know, like, okay, something's going on. I don't think he has this autoimmune deficiency. Like, there's something else going on. So I guess at this point, what are you thinking? Like, do you think, okay, is the kid dangerous or is it something else?
Yeah, I think it's more, ooh, there's a nefarious plot. This kid is definitely being lied to, but we still don't understand the parameters of what.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, I didn't have time to go back and double check this, but there is a brief shot of the car on fire outside before we go into this like confrontation with Dr. Horn and the scalpel. But I didn't really know what to make of it because when we see the car at the end of the film, it is perfectly fine and working.
Yeah, I couldn't tell. I mean, at this point, we don't know, but knowing what happens at the end, I was like, well, did Haley do this?
Yeah. I guess we just assume that somebody else's car, like maybe the nurses or something.
Yeah, or like in Eli's stress, he psychically like manifested like pyrokinesis the car.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's just weird that we don't really spend any time on it and nobody really has a reaction because we're moving things along inside the house.
Yeah, but because the only reason for this car to be on fire is to be like, oh, we can't leave because the car is on fire. But,
exactly.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, as you said, then it's fine.
It's fine. Or we have a new car that Haley has maybe driven up. I don't know.
Or Haley unfired the car.
Sure. Oh, my God. We sound like fucking idiots right now.
I know.
So Eli is threatening Dr. Horn with this scalpel. We get a chase sequence where they try to catch him. He's running all over the place. Again, this is where the geography is not super helpful because, sure, they seem to be everywhere he turns. So he ends up locking himself in her bedroom, I'm going to say, because there is a bed.
Yeah.
But we see this picture of her and you alluded to it a couple minutes ago. She's a full-blown fucking nun. But that habit does not look correct. There's weird symbols on the front of it.
Yeah, but that's what, again, what you were saying about their like their hospital gowns earlier. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's like a cross between a hospital gown and a habit.
Right. Yeah. Which also sounds like the beginning of a joke with no good punchline. So, yes, he ends up following yet another dragonfly / mosquito hawk, and we go from here to a hidden door that leads to a basement, and this is where he is apprehended and thrown into a cage. He has another panic attack, and he passes out.
Because he's going to get locked in this jail cell.
Mm-hmm, it's true. Want to give credit to the camera work here. So when we pick back up with him as he's waking up, the camera is shifting in and out to match his breathing. And I thought that was a really fun way to put us on his level.
I didn't notice that actually. But yeah, again, sucker for good camera work, right? Or just like not even good camera work, but like experimental camera work.
Just something a little different, something a little unique.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So he starts screaming at his mom about why she lied to him about his illness. She ends up coming down and she admits that she was doing it to protect him, but he's actually faking her out because he's like, bah! And this lures her in so that he can smack her with a very large crucifix.
Okay. This is the second movie we've seen where someone gets hit with a stone crucifix and the thunk that you hear.
So satisfying every fucking
time. What was the other one? What did we just... Immaculate.
It's Immaculate. Yeah.
Yes, it's Immaculate.
So, yes, so he knocks her down. He ends up running to the solarium where he has been meeting with Haley. And this is when he tries to break through the window with a fire extinguisher. And she's watching. She's encouraging him. He's going to get immediately caught by Paul and Dr. Horn and the nurses. But Rose is downstairs still in the basement. And when she looks at this fucking giant crucifix, she pulls up the top of it and it is a motherfucking dagger.
And then she's like, what's this well doing in this jail cell?
Yeah, and we just get these petrified child corpses, and it is, well, I was gonna say it's juicy, but it's not, because it is dry.
The bodies look a little moist.
I mean, like, if it was Dune, you're not gonna be able to get enough liquid out of them to sustain you or anything, but yeah. Like,
I... yeah, okay. I love that's where your mind went. Not an important question, but I do wonder why she kept the bodies of these kids and didn't burn them.
Yeah, it almost seems like, oh, I don't want to take these things out. Maybe I want to keep them in a protected space, because there is the insignia from the picture of her habit. So we've got that same symbol or like a pentagram equivalent on the top of the well. So I don't know if that was a, okay, put the corpses in there and then put the lid on and this symbol will protect us.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Either that or we were too lazy to bury child corpses.
Well, no, or we needed someone to discover the bodies.
Well, plot contrivance as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so... we are getting ready to perform procedure number 3. We've got Eli all strapped down on this table, and this is when Rose enters, but she's holding Dr. Horn at dagger's point. So Paul is like, honey, what are you doing? Like, I thought we had a deal here. And the doctor says, we can still save Eli.
His soul, not Eli.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that is a very important point to clarify. And it seems like, okay, Paul's going to side with his wife, but he does not. He turns tables on her and he hands away the dagger.
I saw this coming a mile away, obviously. Oh, sure. But love this because, yeah, everyone, this is when, like, the movie just says fuck it. And
absolutely.
I mean, this, my general thoughts on this movie aside, this whole finale is awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the lights are starting to flicker as all of this drama is going down. But yeah, you know, we've got Eli strapped down. We're ready to proceed, even though Rose is very much not on board with it anymore. So Dr. Horn sets up along with the two nurses. We begin praying and, you know, we're sprinkling holy water and it is absolutely having an effect on Eli.
Oh, yeah. It's basically like acid on his skin.
Absolutely. Yeah. Like it looks really painful. He's scared for his life, obviously. But yeah, those lights, they are flickering. And when we've got this dagger and we're ready to make this ceremonial stab and free his soul and everything, telekinetically stop it before we can puncture this little boy's chest. And then he turns it on her and makes her stab herself.
Okay, so I thought for sure she stabbed herself in the heart, but she is still kicking after this. And
I think it's the shoulder. I think it's like right next to.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe the top of her lung. She like nicked her lung.
There we go. Yeah.
but Horn and these two nurses, they try to leave. And this is awesome.
That's so good. Yeah. He burns through his restraints. Like we just see them go up in smoke. And I think a lot of the time CGI fire looks really fucking awful in movies. And I think it actually looks pretty good here.
It's so funny that this was, you know, Paramount Players, which also released Orphan First Kill, because as much as we love Orphan First Kill, look at the CGI fire in that movie's climax and compare it to this, because believe you me, I was looking, and I also think this fire looks pretty good.
And not good in Orphan First Kill.
It does not look good. But that movie's at least campy. I don't think this one's campy.
This is true. Yeah, this is actually trying to be, like, there's gravitas to this finale, I would say.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it just, the only thing is, I want to see this movie.
But does it hit harder because we spent the whole movie building up to this?
Well, no, the reveal wouldn't have hit harder because, yeah, so absolutely. But I think there's more interesting avenues, like narrative avenues to go down if we just are upfront with this reveal. Nevertheless, sure. Joe, what happens to these women?
Okay, so he is free, and Dr. Horn and these nurses are freaking the fuck out, so they try to make a run for it. They get as far as the door. He stops them. He turns them around. This is all with his mind. Mm-hmm. He levitates them up off the ground after essentially tightening their clothing, like twisting it around so that they are pinned within these religious-y smocks.
Mm-hmm.
Levitates them up off the ground. Flips them over, spreads out their arms, so they're basically upside down devil crosses in human form.
And then they are like spinning.
And then we spin them. Yeah.
Like So how they did this, they had to devise a lighting rig on a huge circular track that could rotate behind the performers to provide both the shadow and the fire effect, which was just amber light, the nurses go by. Meanwhile, a Steadicam circled the performer in the opposite direction to give this like spinning effect while they're spinning at the same time.
Nice. Were they actually upside down? Like, did they have to perform it that way, or did we just flip it?
It sounds like they were, however, because... I do wonder how much of this is actually Lily Taylor and these other two actresses, like, upside down, or if it's maybe, like, dummies, you know?
Right, or stunt performers or something, because it's, like, this is, I mean, it's short in the world of the film, like, it's probably only a couple of minutes, but to film it would have taken a long time, I imagine. Well,
and, y'all, hey, this is basically, like, the setting for Rose finally telling Eli what's going on. But before we even get to the reveal, Eli just immolates all these women. And so we have these like human upside down crucifixes flaming, circling Kelly Riley and this boy. It's awesome.
It's so fucking good.
Awesome.
Yeah. And it's basically like every time she pauses or doesn't answer his question, he's like, okay, fine. I'm going to light these bitches on fire.
But I forgot, Paul is still in the equation.
Paul is still in this equation, yeah. So Rose does come clean. She talks about, how she, basically conceived via the devil and how the devil lied. And, she doesn't actually seem that upset about it, in truth.
Yeah.
But, Paul's still in the mix. And he thinks he's going to save the day. He's going to be a hero. So he tries to sneak up on Eli. And Rose warns Eli. So we get this glimpse that she is still on her son's side. She's coming around to who he truly is. Eli turns around, prevents any kind of attack, and basically just crumples Paul's face right down the middle.
It caves in on itself, and you get a full view of this. I gasped, Joe. I was like, oh my God.
I'm not going to lie. I would have taken a longer shot of it because it is like you get to see it, but then it's kind of over.
Yeah.
And I would have loved to have gotten another shot of it when he's on the ground or something. But it essentially looks like what the third treatment or procedure pictures of the three other kids look like, where their faces are caved in.
Yeah, kind of like that. Because, I mean, it basically looks like his head was, like clubbed in, but there's no weapon. It's invisible. Yeah, this, wow.
We should also note that the three flaming women have been basically cast aside. So they've been thrown against the wall, thrown to the ground, and their bodies are just kind of either cooking or the fires have gone out.
Yeah, we do get a final shot of Lily Taylor's, like, charred-ass corpse on the ground.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it looks great. That looks great too.
Well, because you can still tell it's Lily Taylor, which I appreciate. It's not just like a black husk.
Exactly, right? You know, I want to be able to recognize, oh, that was the queen bitch.
Yes.
And she did.
Absolutely.
Okay, so we're down to just Eli and Rose. So he goes over to his mom and he takes off her cross. throws it away.
Just get that out of here real quick.
Okay, so I'm curious for this part because I remembered that she was still around in the end, but the way that this is initially shot, he gets up and he starts walking. His feet are leaving flaming footprints and mm-hmm. the whole house just goes up in flames behind him. But you don't see Rose. Did you think that he had just left her there to burn?
I did for a little bit, but mm-hmm. I'm glad that's not the case because I think the implication of the ending we have is much more interesting.
No, I 100% agree. And I think it definitely pays off how much we have invested emotionally in their journey over the course of the film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So he's walking through the house. Everything's going up in flame. Looks great. He gets to the door. And so we've not talked about it. His eyes definitely went dark when he was doing all of his telekinetic shit.
Mm-hmm.
And when he gets to the door, his face heals completely. So he is back to, you know, cherub child form. The eyes are back to normal and everything. So he was able to control that. It's like it does come out when he's using his powers, when he is controlled by his emotions.
Mm-hmm.
So waiting for him outside is Haley. She formally introduces herself as his stepsister. And yes, she explains, couldn't tell you, you had to come to your own realization. Also, I couldn't have just outright said it because you wouldn't have believed me, but
blah,
hey,
blah, blah.
Half siblings, do you want to go and meet dad?
Which, again, that's where I'm like, okay, well, we're never going to get this sequel, but holy shit, what could have been with Eli 2? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's the kind of movie where the ending is so good that you think, I would love to watch what happens next.
But again, that's the thing where it's like, I mean, it's not a one-to-one comparison, but it's like, you know, when we get an origin story for something and it's like, oh, mm-hmm. like the way the movie ends is the movie I wanted to see the whole time. So it just feels like a missed opportunity. I get it. Like, again, mm-hmm. I think as a whole, this movie is solid. It's totally fine. Right. 3 stars. But God damn it, do I want to see this movie?
Yeah. So it turns out Rose has survived all of this. So she comes out. She's still very mothering, you know, hey, it's chilly out here. You should put on your hoodie or jumper. And I'm going to bring in Pushko for one last time. So she says, after years of making parenting choices that pushed her son into emotional isolation and physical torment, mm-hmm. Rose ultimately chose Eli over a fate that would demand he be changed or damned. So, I mean, again, if we're looking at this as, yay, the spawn of Satan wins, not a great ending, but if you look at this as a queer rage revenge story, right. if you look at it as a conversion therapy story, this is very much a good for him ending because your mother, who was the most important person, accepts you for who you are and goes on the journey with you at the film's end.
And that's the thing, you know, Eli didn't choose this. I guess that's the only difference where it's not like where I couldn't buy into the queer reading is because his parents made him mm-hmm. like this. Although I guess right. technically your parents do make you queer by just birthing you, so you know,
well, whatever. It's a genetic thing, it's not a choice thing.
What? Oh my god, no, it's not genetics, that's not true.
All I have to do is watch enough heterosexuals kiss and I will be converted back to heterosexuality.
I just always think about it's not horror, but we're just gonna have to cover it, but I'm a cheerleader.
Yeah. Funny stuff.
Everyone,
not my
all
favorite,
of our listeners, but just went
oh, God. On the Patreon. Over
on the
there.
Patreon. On the Patreon. Yeah, I can buy into that.
Yeah. So the movie ends as, I mean, it's very funny to watch Haley because Sadie Sink is quite young in this performance, even though mm-hmm. I think because we actually filmed this and then we had to wait for it, right? Like, so she looks younger than we're used to seeing her on Stranger Things or Fear Street and so on.
Yeah, but she would have been 16 when they filmed this.
Yeah, I would argue that she probably looks about 13 or 14.
I agree. Mm-hmm.
But it's very amusing to watch her, you know, with great confidence, order Rose to drive them to destinations unknown to go and meet the devil.
I know. She's like, we got a long road ahead of us. And I was like, where are you going? Or like, are you just driving to hell?
Yep. Driving to hell. The highway to hell, baby. Yeah. So we just leave this mansion on fire. And that's how the movie ends.
Yep. And we'll never get that sequel. But no. This leads into what could have been a good one.
There we go. You know what? Fan fiction, folks. So, Trace, what would you have liked to have seen if we could have gotten a sequel to this? Is it just them on the road doing various shit? Or do you, like, want to go and meet the devil?
We've got to meet the devil. And I would imagine the devil be played by a wonderful character actor. Who knows who it could be?
Let's see. It could be Tilda Swinton or it could be Tom Ellis.
See, we can't do Tilda, though, because she's, I know where you're pulling that from, because she's the evil angel Gabriel in Constantine. But, like, I don't think we can do that. I would say, I mean, this is like not even about a movie I would want, but I think this would make a really good double feature with Brightburn.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. You know what? Another movie that spent a bunch of its time getting us through the origin story and then leaving us with, oh, don't you want to see that movie? Guess what? It's never going to fucking get made.
And you want to talk about a mean-spirited movie. I think Brightburn is fine, but yeah, whoop boy. That is a mean movie.
It is, yeah.
Well, yeah, so that is Eli, everyone. Joe, final thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I do like this more than you. I just think it's a bit of a surprise, you know? Yeah. I remember being really taken aback at how good it was. You know, it's a very enjoyable watch, and I think that finale really moves it up, you know, about a half star for me, because it is so wild and unexpected. I kind of wish that the whole movie had that energy, but again, I think you need to build up to it to make it pack the punch it does.
Yeah, I mean, I won't repeat everything I've said in this episode because I just feel the exact same way, but I liked watching this, because honestly, I never would have watched it if we weren't covering it. And so I hope that our listeners found like a pleasant surprise out of this movie.
Yeah, hopefully. If you hadn't seen it, this encouraged you to check it out.
I hope so. But, yeah, all right. Well, before we announce what we're covering next week, just some quick housekeeping. If you want to get in touch with us, you can reach us on Twitter and Instagram at HorrorQueers. Shoot us an email at horrorqueers@gmail.com. Find us on Letterboxd to keep track of all the films we've covered. If you want to chat with other listeners, please join our Facebook Horror Queers group. If you have a moment, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Emphasis on the review part of that statement. If you want even more content, please support the show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/horrorqueers. If you subscribe today, you'll get 300 hours of Patreon content, including this month's new episodes on Hannibal Season 1, Episode 4, Late Night with the Devil, Femme, Abigail, and The First Omen. And to coincide with that religious prequel, our audio commentary for the month will be on the original 1976 film, The Omen. But Joe, what are we talking about next week? I'm sure you're happy.
I'm happy, yes, because it's time to revisit some CanCon. It's time to revisit some David Cronenberg. And Trace, we can finally discuss this title because it is a quasi-sequel to a film that you have only just revisited with me on the podcast. So we're going to talk about the unofficial sequel to Videodrome, which is 1999's Existence.
Would it shock you to believe that I prefer Existence to Videodrome?
I do think it's a bit more of an accessible title, but I think you'll get more out of both texts now that you're able to comment on both.
I agree with that. You know, maybe I'll go back and revisit our Videodrome episode just to see what we all thought about it. But yeah, everyone, whereas Videodrome was about TVs, this is about video games and body horror. So, I actually watched this for the first time last year at your behest, and I really, 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 really liked this. So I'm excited to talk about it with you.
Yeah, it's also fun because we get to begin and end the month with Jude Law titles.
Hell yeah, we do. And Jennifer Jason Leigh are really firing on all cylinders in this movie, too.
I fucking love her. And also just getting to say all of these names and the number of times that we don't just say Existence, it's capital X, capital Z.
Oh my God, yes, y'all. That social media post for that are going to be fun. But until then, everyone, we can cross out Eli.
Indeed. And cross out Horror Queers.